So I will just talk about some recent results in a joint paper with Greg Yoff. There is a preprint available on the web. Title of the paper is Reduced Theorems for Actions of Product Groups. And countable Borel equivalence relation. The main point of this paper is to show that there are strong rigidity phenomena when one studies actions of product groups, and then in particular use those to give new and sort of more quote-unquote elementary proofs of several results that have been proved earlier by using more sort of elaborate versions of rigidity theory, which is the so-called Zimmer superrigidity theory. So let me sort of try to sort of outline what we're doing there. First of all, I guess I'll be talking about equivalence relations on polyspaces. And for this talk, all the equivalence relations are going to be countable, which means all the equivalence classes are countable, and Borel, of course. And there's a basic notion of hierarchical order between equivalence relations, which is a notion of reducibility. This is in some space X and this in some space Y. Then this simply means there's a function from X into Y so that if equivalent things go to equivalent things and inequivalent things go to inequivalent things. If we only have one direction, so that's called a reduction. If we only have one direction, that means X equivalent to Y plus F of X is equivalent to F of Y, we call it a homomorphism. Okay, and this defines the partial ordering. There's a corresponding notion of bireducibility. So if this happens with a Borel function f, we say that it is reducible to f. And it is bireducible means that e is reducible to f and f is reducible to e. And there's a strict order. Okay, so one way to understand what that means, this simply means that there is a injection from X mod D into Y mod F, which is sort of Borel in the sense that it has a Borel lifting in the spaces X of Y. This F function F is a Borel lifting of the corresponding function from the quotient space of X to the quotient space of Y. So you can think of this as simply meaning that the Borel cardinality of the quotient space of V is less than or equal to that of F, and that means that they have the same Borel cardinality. I just want to point out one equivalent reformulation of that. It simply means that, so here is the space X and here is the space Y, and here are the E classes and here are the F classes. And to say that they are bireducible can be also understood as follows. There is a complete section of V, So that means a set which meets every class in an unempty set, and there's a complete section of F. So there exists complete sections such that when you restrict the equivalence relations there, they actually become isomorphic. Borel isomorphism is the obvious thing. There's a one-to-one correspondence, Borel correspondence between A and B, which sends E classes to F classes. So this is almost like isomorphism, except that you restrict yourself to complete sections, not necessarily in the whole space. They are not really isomorphic. Also, another way to understand this, another equivalence, it's simply that there is a Borel, because the way this is defined means that there is a Borel injection from the X mod D into Y plus F and vice versa. But you can do, as usual, a Cantor-Bernstein argument and show that this is also equivalent to saying there exists a Borel bijection of X mod E to Y mod F. Well, you have to understand that properly. That means there's a bijection between the spaces so that both for it and its inverse, there's a Borel lifting. I'd like to keep in mind also, in particular, this characterization of this notion, because we want to compare it with some corresponding notions in ergodic theory later on. Okay, so I just want to, I mean, there have been lots of talks about this in the workshop. I just want to briefly summarize a little bit the general picture of this hierarchy of Borel equivalence, Cantor Borel equivalence relations. Among them, the simplest one of the so-called smooth ones, or tame, simply means there's a Borel selector. So these are the simplest countable Borel equivalence relations. And those are sort of quite well understood. There is a sort of direct picture here. It's quite trivial, but yeah. So by in general, let me write this notation here. X is a polyspace, also denotes delta of X, which is the equality relation on X. Okay? So I just identify a polyspace with the equality relation. So in this ordering, the first steps are quite simple. You have the natural numbers, which simply means the equivalence relations with n elements, with n classes. Then you have the equivalence relation with countably many infinite classes. Then you have the smooth equivalence relation with exactly continuing many classes. So that's simply a quality on the reals. Oh, I'm sorry. And these are all the, up to bireducibility, these are all the smooth ones, because the cardinality of the Borel selector is going to tell you what it is, so that's not, that's quite trivial. So all the non-smooth ones, among the non-smooth ones, we have the simplest possible ones, which are the so-called hyperfinite ones. These are increasing unions of sequence of finite, or equivalently smooth equivalence relations. So these are the equivalence relations that you can write like this, where the ends are increasing, and either you can take them to be finite. Finite means the equivalence classes are finite, or you can take them to be smooth. But remember, all my equivalence relations are supposed to be countable. So when I say EN is both countable and smooth. So these are called hyperfinite. And up to this notion of bireducibility, all hyperfinite Borel equivalence layers which are not smooth are the same. They are bireducible to each other, and any one of them you can call E0. So E0 denotes the hyperfinite non-smooth countable Borel equivalence relation. Okay, and this is sort of strictly bigger than this, and there's nothing in between, so that forms an initial sigma here in this order. So this is like this. And then, well, then the picture becomes complicated, but there's one thing at the top of this picture. This is a universal countable Borel equivalence relation. That means one in which you can reduce any other one, and countable Borel equivalence relation. This, of course, again, unique up to bireducibility. And it's, of course, strictly bigger than this one. I mean, this is not obvious, can be shown, though. And sort of this is sort of the general picture. Now, it was also known for quite a while, maybe 10 years or so, that there are countable Borel equivalence relations which are sort of in the middle. Now, they are not hyperfinite, and they are not universal. Okay, so, but sort of until a few years ago, there were only very few examples that were known. There were intermediate ones. Now, there was a great number of examples, of course, of, countable Borel equivalence relations, but one was only able to show that a very small number of them were different. And again, there were about two or three of them, and they were also linearly ordered. I mean, in this ordering, one was below the other. So there was this kind of picture. And of course, you know, this leads to a lot of basic questions like, are there infinitely many different exams? Are there comparable exams and so on? We should keep in mind throughout here, perhaps I should write this at the very beginning here, that every countable Borel equivalence relation is given by the Borel action of a countable group. This is an early result of Feldman and Moore. So if you have a countable Borel equivalence relation, there's some countable group acting on that space whose orbits are exactly the classes. And so study of countable Borel equivalence relation is very closely connected with the study of group action. So a couple of years ago, Scott Adams and myself showed that, in fact, there is a great variety, there's a great number of intermediate relations. In fact, you can embed any Borel partial order into the reducibility order here. So. In fact, the precise result is that the partial order of inclusion among Borel sets can be embedded in the reducibility order on count of the Borel equivalence relation. So the picture here is very complicated. There are infinitely many exams, they're increasing chains, anti-chains, incomparable things, and so on. Moreover, the same arguments were sufficient. I mean, you could use them to also calculate the complexity of this partial ordering in the Borel hierarchy. I mean, here you're comparing Borel sets, but you can call Borel sets by reals. And then you can ask, how complicated to say that one real codes a Borel equivalence relation which is less than or equal to that coded by another real, and it turns out that it was sigma 1 too complete, which is the maximum possible complexity, because just by quantified counting, this relation is sigma 1 too. It says there is a Borel function which embeds the maximum complexity. Okay, now the proofs of these results made sort of heavy use of something that's known as the Zimmer superrigidity theory, which both goes back to the early 80s, and it is basically it comes out of the study of the ergodic theory of actions of lattices in Lie groups. So it's a fairly complex theory that requires a lot of sort of background. The main sort of point that came out in this paper is that there is really a phenomenon of what I refer to as set theoretic rigidity, which is sort of analogous to a phenomenon, again, of what one can call measure theoretic rigidity. Which is a consequence of this superrigidity theory. So let me these are not precisely defined terms. This is just sort of slogans to explain some underlying phenomena here. So I will try to sort of explain informally what I call measure theoretic rigidity, and then what is the analog of it, which I call set theoretic rigidity. So measure theoretic rigidity sort of refers to the following phenomenon. If a group, and my groups here are going to be, just for this discussion, countable. So if a group G acts on a space, again, X is going to be a polyspace, and S space, with invariant measure mu, then the equivalence relation which I'll give it a sort of a name here, I will call it, this is going to be my general notation, that a group G acting on the space X, I call AXG the equivalence relation induced by the Oldsharsky action, the equivalence relation X, together with a measure mu, encode a lot of information about G. So somehow, informally, this means somebody hands you this pair consisting of this and mu, then you know a lot about the G from which it came from. And actually, you know a lot about the action. Of course, this is only under very special circumstances. I'm not saying there's a general theorem about group actions. It says that the group is a certain class of groups, like this lattices of Lie groups and so on. And you have this situation, then you know a lot about the group. In fact, in certain circumstances, for certain kind of results, they are sort of strengthened as a result of Zimmer due to Fermi, which are much more recent. You can actually know, you know exactly what the group is in certain situations. Okay, so that's sort of a phenomenon of measure theoretic rigidity. The equivalence relation and the measure encodes a lot of information about the group. So what is set theoretic rigidity? Well, basically, set theoretic rigidity is a phenomenon where you start with the same situation. You have a group acting with an invariant measure mu. That's sort of the basic ingredient. But then you forget about the measure. You don't pay attention to the measure anymore. You forget about the equivalence relation, in fact. You simply look at the quotient space, and you even forget that, and you only look at Borel cardinality. And that encodes a lot of information about the. So, you can say that on follow. In this context, the Borel cardinality. Now we'll write it this way. Encodes a lot of information. Okay. So you go in a much sort of higher level of abstraction here. You sort of don't have any more of the equivalence relation, so you don't have any more of the measure. You simply look at this set theoretic object, which is simply the quotient space, just a set of orbits. And you even forget that. You only need to know what it is Borel cardinality. And then that already encodes a lot of stuff about G. And so that's sort of what I sort of refer to as phenomenon of set theoretic rigidity. Notice that, of course, if you don't use an effective notion of cardinality, a definable notion of cardinality, if you just simply say the cardinality of this, you get absolutely nothing. Because in any interesting situation, that's going to be 2 to the aleph naught, as a classical. This set has exactly 2 to the aleph naught many elements. But there's a great distinction between these two spaces if you require your bijections are definable, as Borel instead of arbitrary. So you don't have any information whatsoever when you look at classical Cantor cardinality. Okay. So that, of course, this sort of gives you a way of attacking such problems, because if the groups are really encoded in these quotient spaces, or a lot of information about them is, and if you have a reducibility between two things given by groups, and you make your groups to be quite different, you can't expect to have that. You can't expect to have reducibilities or bioreducibilities if you have appropriate actions and with groups that are different, because then you would you run into this phenomenon here. So for example, you can use this. So let me give an example of an application of this. This will produce, for instance, an example of a strictly increasing sequence of equivalence relations here, an infinite leaf. And as you will notice from these exams, and in fact from everything else that's going on in the subject, the situation that you are dealing with, the problem is not to construct artificial examples. I want to emphasize this point. It's not to sort of find two examples which are incomparable, two things and infinitely many different things. The problem is you have a great variety of examples around, natural examples, as we will see in a second. The problem is how to tell them apart. And that's sort of a classical problem and difficulty, for instance, one has in ergodic theory, how you distinguish different automorphisms and things like that, naturally given automorphisms. So that's what the problem is. The problem is not to construct artificially examples here. We have a sort of a great number of natural examples here, but how do we tell them apart? That's what the problem is. So that's where the difficulty is. So, for example, if you take the group ZLNZ, which is the group of all n by n integer matrices with determinant plus or minus 1, and you have this acting on the n-dimensional torus by matrix multiplication, then as an example of this set of rigidity, you obtain the following. If you look at the TNs for different n's as sets, first of all, they all have the same cardinality, because 2 to the aleph naught. But even if you look at them from the point of view of the effectivity of Borel cardinality, they're all the same. There's a Borel bijection between any two uncountable Pauli spaces. However, when you look at these quotient spaces, you recover invariance of dimension. The Borel cardinality of that is equal to the Borel cardinality of this, if and only if musical trend. So they can possibly
be the same.
And in fact, you get that you have a strictly increasing. This is sort of a bad notation to abbreviate this. This abbreviates that. So here is how you get an increasing sequence. But you know, notice that this is a very natural and well-studied action. It's not that somebody just constructed some peculiar sequence of equivalence selections here. How do you get, for instance, incomparable ones? Well, I will look at the another kind of canonical action, which is the so-called shift action, or Bernoulli actions. So in general, suppose I have a countable group gamma. There is an action of gamma on 2 to the gamma, which is called the shift action. So this is called the shift of Bernoulli action. It has a canonical invariant measure, namely the usual product measure. Right? So we assign to 2 the 1/2, 1/2 measure and take the product measure. So this certainly is in the context of groups with invariant measures. And you could call the corresponding equivalence relation. You sort of write it like this. I mean, this would be this in this more elaborate notation. But I also want to look at the free. This is not necessarily free in the sense that there are group elements at fixed points here. For example, the constant function is going to be fixed by any group element. So sometimes I want to look at the free part of the action for which I write this kind of notation. This is a set of all functions like that, so that for every group element, which is not the identity, I have that it's moved. This is an invariant set of measure 1 with respect to the usual product measure. So certainly from the point of view of ergodic theory, everything concentrates here. That's not quite true from the point of view of set theory. This turns out to be, in fact, a much smaller set than this from the point of view of reducibility or Borel cardinality theory. But in any case, let me call F the corresponding. F stands for free. This is when you're restricted to the free part. So that's the part I want to look at. For example, if you take gamma equals F2, the free 2 gain generator, and you look at this, it's going to give you the universal one. But if you look at the free part, if you look at this, it's going to give you something which is strictly in between those two. So there's a big difference. From the point of view of ergodic theory, these are the same because we concentrate on a set of measure 1. From the point of view of set theory, the cardinality, so to speak, of the free part is much smaller than actually the cardinality of the whole thing. So we look at the free part. And then in the original paper that I mentioned up there, we had to choose appropriately the groups to apply the superrigidity theory. And for various technical reasons, the following groups sort of worked out. These are sort of groups of matrices. So for each prime number P, you can consider the group of 7x7 matrices, special orthogonal group, right? So that it's this multiplied by transpose is the identity. And these are the entries come from the ring of integers where you add 1 over p. So it turns out that rigidity tells you that when you look at actions of this, the p is somehow encoded in it. And therefore you can get as a corollary that when you look at the shift action, the free part of the shift action, of this can be only reduced to this for another prime if and only if the two primes are the same. So you can't even compare them. They form an incomparable set. Okay. Not only they cannot be bireducible to each other, but they cannot be even compared. And that gives you, of course, an infinite set of incomparable things. But again, notice that these are canonical actions that are there. I mean, you know, they're just some group of matrices, and you look at the shift of this group of matrices, and what you have is incomparable set. Okay. So, so it's certainly very important to try to understand this phenomenon of structural relativity. It's not a, as I said, I mean, I wrote it in sort of general terms, but it's not a general phenomenon, so you take whatever group you like and you're going to have this phenomenon. It's very specific to what groups you choose and actions that you choose. So it's very important to understand what's going on here. What is sort of this phenomenon of rigidity? Where does it apply? So that's what I'll be talking next. I mean, I'm trying to make some sense out of this. Wonder what kind of understanding we have. Well, in trying to understand this phenomenon of set theoretic rigidity, the first thing sort of to realize is that there's an important dividing line, where sort of on the one side you have rigidity phenomenon, and on the other side you have the opposite. You have sort of what I refer to as elasticity phenomenon. So the basic dividing line is amenability versus non-amenability. So roughly speaking, very, very roughly speaking, one should not take this distinction as literal. At the level of amenability, you get elasticity phenomena. You can't tell anything apart. Everything kind of looks the same. But here is where you start getting strong rigidity phenomena. But again, they are not as general in the sense that anything which is non-amenable is this problem. So what do I mean by amenability? A group is called amenable if it has, let's say, a left invariant measure defined on all its subsets. And a group is non-amenable if it doesn't. A good approximation of what does it mean to be non-amenable is to think that it has a free subgroup with more than one generator. It's not quite true. There are non-amenable groups that don't have this problem, but for all practical purposes, at least in the beginning, it's convenient. It's a simple thing. These are things that contain free groups with more than one generator. Okay, so examples of amenable groups are, of course, Z, abelian groups, solver groups, etc. Again, here, anything that contains a free group is in this class of non-amenable groups. Okay, so let me sort of discuss a little bit sort of the distinction between these two things. Let me discuss why here we have sort of elasticity and why here we have rigidity. So I need to go back and review some results from ergodic theory. So let me introduce a little bit of, unfortunately, another terminology here. So suppose we're in the context now, we have a space, polyspace, let's say a countable Borel equivalence relation and a probability measure. All my measures in these discussions are going to be probability measures. Probability Borel measures, we don't have to worry about other things. And you have another one. So, polyspace, countable Borel equivalence relation measure mu. And I also want to, I mean, in the cases that I'll be interested in, all the measures are going to be invariant. So this measure mu is going to be invariant. Well, what does it mean to be an invariant measure for an equivalence relation? Well, remember, every equivalence relation is given by a group action. So to say the measure is invariant simply means it's invariant under a group generating it. Of course, the group generating is not uniquely determined, and the action is not uniquely determined. But you can easily check that if you have some group that generates C, and this measure is invariant for this action, it's invariant for any other action that generates C. That's a simple exercise. So the concept is well-defined in that context. In fact, the notion of invariance is well-defined for equivalence relations, not just actions, countable equivalence relations. Okay. So in this context, we say that these two objects are orbit equivalent. So, I mean, when the measure and the space is understood, I would just simply say E. So E is orbit equivalent to F. Simply means that they are isomorphic modular null sets with an isomorphism that preserves the measures. So, I mean, this simply means are isomorphic modular null sets. Of course, Borel isomorphic. So that means that two conal sets, one in this space and one in this space, we can take them invariant of the Cleveland insulation, and there's a Borel bidirection between these two conal sets that sends nu to nu and nu to f. So it's literally the notion of isomorphism. It's called orbit equivalence because, actually, this is a little bit of a misnomer here. Usually people, when you think of V and F as being generated by group action, then there are two notions of isomorphisms. First of all, the concept of isomorphism for the actions themselves. You have to preserve the action. And then the second is where you only preserve the equivalence relation, and that's called orbit equivalence. And then we sort of abuse this terminology here, and we forget about the groups acting, and we just say the equivalence relations are orbit equivalent. Probably a better name here would be just simply say that Borel isomorphic. But since I want to distinguish between the set theoretic context, which there are no measures, and the measure theoretic context, I'd rather stick with a different name. Because this one has to preserve the measure.
You preserve the measure?
Yes. Here you have to. Well, when I say equivalence relations are Borel isomorphic, there's no measure, so you don't preserve anything. But this is literally the concept of isomorphism in the category of measured equivalence relations.
Why do you say
you're allowed to throw away null sets? In other words, the isomorphism doesn't have to be from all of it to all of it.
Because you're throwing the null sets
because we're in the context of a measure space. So, of course, in the context of a measure space, we neglect null sets. Okay? Yeah. So you have more flexibility. But so, I mean, in this context, I mean, we have basically two categories, the set theory category, in which everything is Borel, there are no measures, and the measure theory category, in which there are measures. We have analogous definitions, but in the measure theory category, of course, we are always unknowing the possibility of forgetting about null sets. In the set theoretic, we're not. That's a very important distinction. So if you take the shift action that I mentioned before, and you look at the free part and the non-free, the general part, measure theoretically it would be the same, but not so theoretically. So. Okay, and then we also say that the E and the F are stably orbit equivalent. By the way, I will abbreviate that by that's the analog of the bireducibility. If they become isomorphic when you restrict them to sets that meet every orbit. So, it's Borel isomorphic when restricted to complete Borel sections. Again, modular null sets. All right, so this is sort of like summarizes a lot of things, but this is what I mean. We're in the situation where we have measures here, and we have equivalence relations. What does it mean to be stably orbit equivalent? It means that there is a Borel set that meets almost every orbit. So we can say it meets every orbit for getting a null set. Similarly here. And now the measures, because this is a complete section, you can easily check that the measure of the set of the section must be positive. Otherwise, the measure of the whole space would be zero. Then you can restrict the measure to the section and normalize it. So they have a probability measure, divide by the measure of A. Do the same thing here. When you look at these restricted equivalence relations measures, then become isomorphic. So they're in a sense isomorphic, but you're allowed to restrict yourself to a set of positive measures, which meets every class. So that's called the stable orbit equivalence. It's a weaker notion than orbit equivalence. And it corresponds exactly, I mean, orbit equivalence in the set theoretic category is Borel isomorphism. Stable orbit equivalence in the set theoretic context is bireducibility. So we have this set of notions, right? On one side, the measure theoretic, the set theoretic side, and they're exactly equivalent.
And do you want to share that the normalized measure should
match exactly? Yes, yes. There are isomorphic as in the measure category. When you restrict everything to A and to B, they become isomorphic in the measure theoretic category.
Make a difference if you just ask for mutual absolute continuity.
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, it depends on the context. But, I mean, here I'm talking in the case of invariant measures. Mm-hmm. And if we're also assuming, as we usually do, that the measures are ergodic, then it doesn't make that much difference because, I mean, we can't, at least the absolute continuity has to be the same.
So that's not it.
There's another sort of more general context than this, which I'm not going to talk about, where you don't require that these measures are invariant. You're only assuming they're quasi-invariant. And then you have the whole analog concepts for the quasi. But I mean, don't want to throw in too many different contexts here. So everything is invariant here. Okay. So what's going on here in the context of amenability? If gamma and delta are amenable, let's say infinite to avoid triviality groups, and act, and again to avoid sort of triviality, let's say act freely, no fixed points, with invariant measure. On, let's say, the first one acts on mu, on x with mu, and the second one acts on y with mu. Then, let's see, I guess I need to assume that these are ergodic. Ergodic means that there are no invariant sets except the null set in the whole space. Okay. So if we look at invariant ergodic actions of these groups, then we get exactly the same equivalence relation. In the measure theoretic context. One gets exactly the same equivalence relation. So that's what I call elasticity here. You can't tell apart what the groups are. They all give you the same stuff if they're amenable. Okay. So the equivalence relation and the measure don't encode anything here. They do encode one thing. I don't want to go into that. That's a simple really exercise. If somebody gives you this, you know at least that gamma is amenable. That's all you know. Now, if you have, let's put it this way. Suppose you have another group, gamma prime, which acts freely, ergodically, et cetera, in some other space, x prime. And the action on x and the action on n prime are orbit equivalent, then if gamma is amenable, gamma prime is going to be amenable. So the information of amenability is encoded in this object here. But that's all it's encoded. So you can tell apart, for instance, just to sort of illustrate the difference between this and other things I will talk about. For instance, if you take gamma to be z to the n, the integers, the nth part of the integers, and delta to be z to the m, the mth part of the integers, then you cannot tell apart zn and 2z to the m looking at their actions, because they will be all, they're amenable groups, so they're going to be the same. Okay. Well, I'll sort of take them to be ergodic here so that they have this, one is ergodic, the other one. I mean, I just consider the ergodic case only.
Oh, yeah.
What?
Well, I mean, it's
not come down to the ergodic. Let's simplify. I want to keep it as simple as context. I want to talk about ergodic composition. So. Okay. So that's all. I mean, you don't have any difference. Now, so this is as far as measure theoretic elasticity is concerned. How about set theoretic? Well, what would be the set theoretic of this? If you take two amenable infinite groups which act freely, forget measures now, on two spaces, then you would expect these two things here by themselves to be bireducible, let's say. Can't literally be isomorphic in this case, but bireducible. Now, that should be true, but it hasn't been proved yet. I mean, it's an open problem. And, I mean, the reason that this is true is because this combines two theorems. It combines the theorems of, a theorem of die, or rather, well, it combines first, let's say, a theorem of Kohn-Feldman-Weiss that tells you that when gamma is amenable, this thing is hyperfinite almost everywhere. And then the second theorem of die says that if this is hyperfinite, I mean, if you take any two hyperfinite things, then they're orbit equivalent. So we have a combination of two theorems. First of all, that amenability implies hyperfiniteness, and secondly, that hyperfinite things are all the same in the measure of every context. Now, in the saturated context, we know that hyperfinite things, at least up to bireducibility, they're all the same. That has been proved. But what we don't know yet is that if you just forget about measures, now we don't say almost everywhere, but everywhere, if you look here, let you look at the action of an amenable group on a space X, we don't know if this is hyperfinite almost. That's only proved up to polynomial growth finite generated groups. So there's still an open problem here in the general context whether they are set theoretically, so to speak, always the same. Now, is they're always hyperfinite. Okay, so that's sort of what's going on in the amenable context. I mean, you have sort of this kind of elasticity. Now, what is going on in the non-amenable context? Well, this Zimmer superrigidity theory, for instance, allows you to show that you have strong rigidity phenomena in certain classes of groups, like, for example, lattices in Lie groups. And in particular, this is the kind of thing that can be used with further extensions to imply corresponding set theoretic rigidity for some things like that. So this allows you to resolve these questions here. Now, I'm not going to talk too much about that part. For instance, I guess in the there were several talks about that in the workshop. What I would like to sort of to restrict myself here is to some sort of the simplest, in some sense, non-amenable groups, namely the free groups, and things which are close to them. So I will really concentrate myself on free groups. Of course, I assume there are free groups with more than one generator, because otherwise, I mean, Z is in that category. So I want to sort of discuss what kind of rigidity phenomena we have for free groups. So here I will start from the measure theoretic context, and then discuss more at the end about the set theoretic context. So it was open for a long time in ergodic theory whether there were actually rigidity phenomena in the measure theoretic context, in the context of orbit equivalence. For example, the basic question was, is it possible to distinguish, for instance, the rank of a group? Suppose you have an action of F2 and an action of F3. Is it possible for them to be an orbit equivalent, to be isomorphic? In other words, does an action of this group encode the rank of the group? So that was, notice that instead of taking free groups, we take free abelian groups, like Z to the N, the answer is no, it doesn't encode. Right? So there's a difference. An open problem for quite a while. It was eventually solved about 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, by Gaboriau, who showed that, among other things, that when you have FM acting on X with invariant measure mu, and let's say FN acting on Y with invariant measure mu, my assuming is always that my actions are free, invariant measure, then if the corresponding equivalence relations are orbit equivalent, notice that the corresponding equivalence relations are isomorphic, then N equals N. Implies, I guess, is the way it wrote. So if you have any free action of this, FM, which is isomorphic, whose equivalence relation with the corresponding measure is isomorphic to that of FN on some other space with a corresponding measure, then M must be equal to N. You can't have free action of F2 and a free action of F3 with invariant measures being isomorphic in the measure theoretic context. So that was, one of his main results. In order to do that, he developed something known as the theory of cost. So the concept of a cost was invented earlier by Levitt. Yes, he was Gaboriau's advisor. Anyway, so, but then the first sort of important use of it was in these problems was made by Gaboriau to solve this question. Yeah. Basically, the concept of the cost, I'm not going to get into that, it's far away from what I want to talk about. The idea of cost is when you have the situation where you have a measure, I mean, an equilibrium relation with an invariant measure mu, you can assign a number to it, call it the cost of the equivalence relation relative to that measure, which is a real number. And this number is invariant under orbit equivalence. If you have two things that are orbit equivalence, you must assign the same number. So it's an invariant of orbit equivalence. And then the main problem is how you calculate that. And in the cases where the equivalence list is given by free group action, where the group has m generators, the calculation gives you the number m. And that's one of the main results of Gaboriau, how to calculate that. And therefore, in particular, this gives you this. So he found this kind of invariant called the cost, which distinguishes between equivalence lists. Okay. So, and this is particularly, ideas are particularly effective. As always, the problem is to calculate this invariant, which means to calculate this cost, and you want this invariant to distinguish things. And this idea is particularly successful when you study actions of free groups. For example, it's not very successful if you simply, for instance, you replace a free group by, let's say, the product of the free groups, because then the cost trivializes, it becomes always one, so you can't tell them apart. So throwing some commutativity into the groups tends to push down the concept of the cost becomes one, and then you can't tell them apart. So, okay. Now, on the other hand, I want to point out an important thing here, namely that this kind of thing requires, it's only true because you're assuming that these two things are actually isomorphic, that they're the same. Suppose you require things are a little bit weakened, namely stably orbit equivalent, which simply means that their quotients are the same, measure theoretically. Orbit equivalent means they are the same as equivalence relations. Stably orbit equivalent means their quotients are the same, measured theoretically. So if you require that, then this is false. So that's an important phenomenon. There exists three, let's say, make them to be even nicer, ergodic, measure-preserving, stable orbit equivalent actions of the group F2 and the group F3. This is simply because you can think of F3 as being a finite index subgroup of F2, and so that when we are dealing with finite indices, you can't tell the difference really between in the stable orbit equivalent. So there are, if you pass from the equivalence relation itself into the quotient space, you lose this rigidity, even in the context of free groups, which of course suggests that it's going to be quite difficult to do something like that in the Borel theoretic context. So, in fact, until very, very recently, it wasn't clear whether there was sort of any rigidity whatsoever in the context of actions of free groups. In other words, any actions of free groups, any free actions of the group, they look the same as far as Borel by the disability was concerned than any other one. So let me make that a little more precise here. When you look at actions of free groups, and by that I always mean free actions of the free groups. I mean, if you look at actions of free groups in general, they give you anything, right? Because if you take the free group with countably managed, you can map it on any other group, so any action of any group is really an action of the free group with infinitely many generators. So it's important to look at free actions of the free groups, not to hide the group. So if we look at free actions of free groups, we get a class of equivalence lists which are known as triable. countable Borel equivalence notation is called triable if you can put on each equivalence class a tree structure. A tree structure in the sense of graph theory, an acyclic connected graph. But of course, not in a trivial way, namely in a uniform Borel way, that the assignment has to be done in a uniform. In other words, you can define, let's say, a Borel graph whose connected component, which is acyclic, has no cyclic, and whose connected components are the equivalence class. That's what it means to be triable. But from the point of view of what I'm describing here, you can just simply think of triable. This is not a definition, but it's a characterization, as being the equivalence relations by reducible to those induced by free actions of free groups. So as far as sort of the quotient space are concerned, triable equivalence relations are the same as the things that are given by free actions of free groups. Okay. So that's what we're looking at here. So what do we know about these things? Or actually, what did we know until recently? Well, there are always some things like that that are smooth, that they have Borel selectors. We don't care about that. Among the non-smooth ones, of course, there is the smallest one, because among all the non-smooth equivalence relations, there's the smallest one, namely the hyperfinite one. So this is given simply by a free action of the group Z. The hyperfinite ones are exactly the equivalence relations given by Z actions, free Z actions. Okay. But it turns also there's the biggest one, which we call the universal triable one. Universal triable. And this is simply can be realized as being the free part of the shift action of F2, let's say. If you look at 2 acting on what I call the free part, so that it's a free action, then I look at the equivalence relation, that's it. Remember, if I don't take the free part and I take the whole space, then I get the universal equivalence relation. But this is much smaller than the universal countable equivalence relation. In other words, in the big picture, this is when I look at the action of F2 on the whole space, or all the whole sheet. If I look at this, this is somewhere down here. It's much smaller than this. Okay. So up to until very recently, these were the only 2 known examples. Now, there was every free action of F2 that we knew how to calculate was either this or that. So you could have again a sort of an elasticity phenomenon. You can tell apart actions of the free groups. They all look the same. I mean, as long as they are not hyperfinite. For instance, if you take all of those that admit an invariant measure, then they cannot be hyperfinite. Therefore, they would all be the same. So for example, we didn't know whether any free action of a free group with invariant measure is the same. They're all the same. So that was what was recently done by Jörg, where he showed that there are certain actions of F2 that are strictly intermediate here, the so-called modular actions. There are actions on trees. Actions of free groups on trees give you equivalence relations which are called modular, and these are strictly between those two. But that's basically all we know at this stage in terms of distinguishing actions of F2. I mean, there's this class of universal actions, and there's this class of modular actions, and they're different. But we don't know any other different examples. And it's not that there are lots of different actions of the free groups and groups close to them, but we can't distinguish them at this stage anymore. So that's a very interesting problem. I mean, there's probably quite strong rigidity phenomena here, but it's very hard to know what properties you need to distinguish different actions of the free groups. And that's, of course, I'll get into that in a second. I mean, there's a corresponding problem in ergodic theory. As I said before, these results of Gaboriau distinguish in the measure theoretic context actions of groups with different number of generators. Right? But what if you take the same group, let's say F2, and you look at actions of F2? Can you distinguish actions of F2? You can't use this stuff anymore because you always get the cost equal 2. So you have to use some other invariant. And people don't really know how to do that. There are only, I think, now 4 distinct examples of actions of F2. There were 3 before, but this is out of yours to use a 4th one. So it's a very sort of unsatisfactory state of affairs. You know, one has among all the actions of the same group, F2, there are only 4 distinct examples. And this is quite a bit of interest to people, for instance, working in theory of operator algebras, because there are problems of that sort that show up also in that theory, how to distinguish Feynman algebras that are generated by groups with different number of generators and so on. So there's people are sort of arriving at these problems from different angles. But the main sort of point I want to make is that at this stage, as far as free groups are concerned, we're sort of at the very beginning and really trying to understand how different actions arise of free groups. In some sense, there's very limited information available. And especially trying to find out what kind of methods one can use for distinguishing actions of free groups. Especially this, when you're dealing with the same group. I mean, how do you think the different actions of the same group? That's an interesting problem. Okay, so so this is sort of, by the way, sort of a general background into this kind of rigidity phenomenon. What are the difficulties one is dealing with? It turns out that in that paper that I sort of, the paper with yours that I started with, the main results are to show that if instead of looking at the free groups themselves, you start looking at products of free groups in particular or other kinds of groups, you get quite strong rigidity phenomena. So if you replace free groups themselves, which are sort of obviously difficult to handle, by products of such groups or related groups, then you do get very strong rigidity phenomena. And in particular, these allow you to recover, so to prove by sort of, you know, in a different way, all these applications of the Zimmer's rigidity theorem and further things that came afterwards in the context of Borel equivalence relations by using, instead of using, you know, lattices in Lie groups, etc., which requires sort of a lot of background to show that they work, you can use sort of the rigidity phenomena that appear in product groups. And the advantage of that is that, in some sense, in court, these are, the rigidity phenomena are more elementary, in the sense that you don't require a lot of background information to sort of prove this rigidity phenomena, but they can be done with sort of, the only sort of background that you need is sort of some basic measure theory and function analysis. On the other hand, one should sort of emphasize that the ideas that come and prove this rigidity phenomena are sort of like in the, there's a sort of core of ideas that come in the super rigidity theory and all the other things that came before that work of Mostar and Margulis, etc. And in some sense, you use the core of these ideas, but you implement them in a much more elementary way. So that the core of the ideas in the machinery is sort of there. You sort of manage to sort of just use only the hard core of this, and instead of implementing them for these groups like SLN, etc., which are complicated to work with, at least for set theories, you replace them by just adding product groups. And the reason that, in some sense, it's easier, I mean, there are various reasons, but one reason is that one thing that makes these other groups work is that, for instance, these groups of matrices, etc., is that there's some kind of a commutativity available there, which actually, one important reason that I mentioned, for instance, these things work for groups that have rank and 2 or higher. I mean, you remember these groups get the 7 there. Actually, in other exams, you get some things that have a 3x3 matrices. They don't work, for instance, with 2x2 matrices. And that's because of algebraic properties. You don't have enough commutativity. But in the case when you replace these things by groups, which are product groups, your commutativity is there. It's freely available. So you take advantage of the fact that you work with groups in which there's a lot of commutativity. And this allows you to implement the core ideas of sort of super rigidity in a much more elementary way to avoid all the sort of superstructure that comes with these other things. So that is in a sense. So So let me talk a little bit about rigidity for product groups. Actually, as it turned out, the fact that there are sort of interesting rigidity phenomena when you study, what I mean by products, I mean things like F2 cross F2 or things like F2 cross Z, things like that. Products of simple groups that are very close to free groups. And actually, as it turned out, such phenomena, I mean, have been dealt with sort of recently in the last year or so from sort of three different angles. So, the earliest, I guess, in this sort of chronologically, came through again work of Gaboriau, who sort of again proved rigidity phenomena for product groups when you start taking five copies of F2 and three copies of F2. How do you distinguish them, et cetera, things like that. Products, F2 to the fifth and F2 to the fourth. He introduced, you can't use the cost invariant because the cost in both cases is one. This. You can tell five copies of F2 from three copies of F2. He introduced some new invariants which are inspired from algebraic topology, and these are called L2 Betti numbers. And he also introduced similar ideas called, related ideas called ergodic dimension and other invariants like that. But for instance, would allow you to distinguish actions of five copies of F2 with three copies of 29 or other things like that. I won't try to explain what these things are, but I could just simply say that in some sense what's going on is the following. When you study actions of free groups like that, you're basically dealing with trees, with triable equivalences. What's the point? If you have an action of F2 which is free, then on its equivalence class, on its orbit, you can put a copy of the Cayley graph of F2. That's the tree that you're really putting. Right? If you just simply look at the graph, the Cayley graph, you just simply put a copy of that on its orbit because it's a free action. So you can just copy that. So when you are dealing with actions of this, you are basically dealing with equivalence metrics which are triable, with trees. Now what Gaboriau essentially did is he replaced trees by higher dimensional analogs. And what are the higher dimensional analogs? They are finite dimensional contractible simplicial complexes. One of the characterizations of trees, or the fancy characterizations of trees, is simply a one-dimensional simplicial complex. Well, instead of one, put two, three, four. Well, what are examples of this? Start taking products. Products of contractive simplicial complexes become contractive simplicial going to higher dimensions. So that's why you can start, you know, if you start instead of three of the things which admit simplicial, contractive simplicial complexes, then this allows you to introduce new invariants, and these are these L2 Betti numbers which I want to explain here. And then he sort of using the new invariants, he could distinguish in the measure theoretic context actions of product groups. So that's one approach. This is somewhat elaborate machinery, even to define what these invariants are. You have to sort of use things from the theory, for instance, of polynomial algebra and so on, it's ideas from algebraic topology and so on. So that's sort of one approach. The other approach is the one that we used in a paper with York, which is essentially to go back, so to speak, to the core of the superrigidity theory, try to sort of see exactly, in some sense, what is really the point of that and implement it in such a way that one strips out sort of a lot of the technicalities that are associated with using lattices in big groups and so on. I mean, there's another issue, namely, another important thing that comes up here is that you're using another important ingredient, which is that the free groups have some very, very nice actions, which are the so-called actions on their boundary. A free group is, you can think of it as a Cayley graph, which is a tree. Then this Cayley graph has infinite branches. And then the group acts on the space of infinite branches, and it turns out that the so-called boundary action has very nice properties, which are used in all sorts of different things. And that's an important ingredient to also in this So there's the product groups and the boundary actions that make sort of this kind of thing work quite nicely and can do things in a more elementary way. So that's sort of the second approach. And the third approach, which sort of came simultaneously with this one, is in a series of papers by Morneau and Shalom, two people working geometry and ergodic theory. And there they use a quite fancy machinery called bounded cohomology, which I have no idea what it is. It's a kind of machinery which was developed a lot in Morneau's thesis. And they sort of found some nice applications which produce also very nice and strong rigidity results for product groups as well. So, but this sort of is a machinery that requires quite a bit of background and so on. And certainly I'm not familiar with it. Okay, so let me sort of, so these are sort of three different ways of, I mean, three approaches. I mean, these approaches are sort of, sometimes they have some overlap in the sense that you can do some things with other, but in some, many times they're just complementary. You sort of prove some things with one approach, some other things with one approach, and then you can put them all together to get a more general picture. I won't try to explain exactly what are the results that we prove here, because the main results here are results about so-called co-cycles. The main thing, I mean, I will say at the end what a co-cycle is and how this is important, but these are results that tell you something about certain structure of objects which are called co-cycles. Then you sort of apply those to the particular case of equivalence relations and you obtain various applications. So I will talk about the application, or a couple of applications. I won't say many of the applications, but I will say a couple of the applications, especially those that refer to this questions that I discussed earlier. So one application which is in the paper is, for instance, to give a sort of a new way of producing the result that I mentioned up there, that you can embed the partially ordered of inclusion among Borel sets into the reducibility relation. And it's based on the following result. Suppose S is a set of odd primes. Then you take the following group. It's a free product. Why don't I just take a special case? I'll just take a special case. So let's take P be an odd prime. I won't try to state the more general result, which is giving this kind of thing. I just will give you a list of incomparable things, for instance. So let me take gamma sub T to be simply this group. Okay. Z sub T is the integers mod T, finite group. And this is the free product. So this is a group with two generators, A and B, which satisfy the relation A to the P equals B to the P equals 1. Now this is almost the free group. It's a finite index free group. It's almost a free group. And then you simply cross it with Z. So if you simply take, I mean, what I want to look at is, of course, the shift action of that. Remember, the free part of the shift action. And the result is that if this can be reduced to the same thing for Q, then P equals Q. What it means? The shift, the Bernoulli shift of this group codes P. That's what it says. In a very strong sense. You can't compare any two of them unless the P is the same. So that, of course, gives you an infinite list. Notice that this is kind of epsilon above this. And this is simply, I mean, if you simply take the shift of that, that's essentially the free group. It gives you the shift of F2, which is simply the universal count of the equivalence list. It's this. So if you forget about the Z, they're all the same. These things are all the same. So this by itself codes nothing. That's what I'm trying to emphasize. But somehow when you cross it with Z, because you introduce this commutativity here, suddenly a lot of this is causing. That's the point. And this thing, in fact, if I replace Z here by a local finite group, let's say the direct sum of Z2s, let's say something like that, this will be, this equivalence relation will be an increasing union of triable ones. So they will be sort of just above here. Remember, below here, between here and here, we don't know. We just know one example more. I mean, we don't know whether there are different things in contrast or not. But just before, below, above that, you start getting this phenomenon. And in fact, they come out of simply the Bernoulli shifts of very, very simple groups. And you can move this up a bit, build this up a little bit to give you this other thing. Start taking direct, free products of such groups, and you get lots of things like that. Okay, so that's one example. Another example, I guess I probably won't write it here because it's not that much in the Borel context, but in the measure theoretic context. I mentioned before that you can have actions of F2 and actions of F3 which are stably orbit equivalent. Measure theoretic, measure preserving actions, free measure preserving actions of F2 and F3, which have the same quotient. You can have two things for which have the same equivalence relations. That's Gaborio's theorem, but you can have the same quotient. However, you can use these methods to show that if you cross them with Z, they can be stably ordered to them. So you recover the rank, even in the quotient space, when you cross these groups with Z. So if you have two free actions with invariant measures of this group and this group, and they have the same measure theoretic quotient, then, I mean, M and N here, then M equals N. So somehow the presence of this additional factor Z allows you to recover, in this stronger form, reduce the phenomena that are even absent in the measure theoretic context if you don't describe them. So there you can tell the thing. So that's sort of another kind of application. So that's one, two, stable orbit equivalence rigidity for Z groups. Here? No, for the free groups they're arbitrary. No, the primes are here. And then finally, sort of mention, just let me draw a picture. I mean, I will just mention one more example of this to draw. And I will just draw a picture for that. So, as I said, you can sort of make, I mean, by just taking free products here with different p's, you can produce a lot of examples that allow you to prove the general form of that thing. So this is just a special case. Now, I'm going to mention another example, which is, I'll just do it by drawing a picture. So let's go down here and start from the universal triable equivalence relation here. So this is simply the free part of the action of this two. Okay. So that's the largest possible action of a free group. Now you can create sort of two strands here. In one, you start taking products. So let me give this a name. Okay, it's just anyway, it's infinitive thing. So let me take the product of this with hat of finite equivalence relation with zero. And then let me sort of start taking products. So, okay? So I'm basically taking these two ingredients. I mean, the hyperfinite one, which is down here, the universal triable one, which is up here, and then I start taking products. Take the product of these two, gives me this, the product, two copies of this plus one copy. It doesn't matter whether, if I take more copies of E0, I don't get anything new because E0 to the N is equal to E0. So I get this. Well, one of the applications is that this forms a strictly increasing sequence. So we have a dimension here encoded, here, how many products. But then there's another way to take products. Instead of looking, I mean, this is basically what? How do you view this thing as an action? E infinity of t is the shift action of F2, the free part. The square of it is the product of two shift actions. If you take three, it's the product of three shift actions. But instead of doing that, you can take the shift action of the product. So you get, for instance, the shift action of this. So this is an action, the shift action of F2 cross Z, while this thing here, for instance, is the product of one action of F2, the shift action of F2 with the shift action of Z. The product action here is the shift action. And then you can do the same things for, you can sort of start alternating. So basically what we have here is the product of the shifts, and here we have the shift of the product. Right? So the relationship between those things is the following. Put this up here. The relations are exactly this. And in other words, this is strictly smaller than that, and this is strictly smaller than that. So what does that mean? That means the product of two shift actions is strictly smaller than the shift of the product, and so on. Right? And these are the only relations between those things, which means in particular the following sort of peculiar fact, that if you take, for instance, the product of three things here, you know, this is the product of three shift actions, and you take the shift of the Cartesian product of two copies, these are incomparable. While if you take the product of two things, this is less than that. The reason that this is strictly less than that is that this is some action of F2 cross F2, and this is the shift action. The shift action is always the most complicated. So any action of a product group is going to be less than or equal to its shift action. But because this is a product action, somehow it ends up being simpler. So here you get another list, if you want, of very interesting and very explicit things that cannot be compared. You cannot compare the shift of a number of product groups with respect to the product of the shifts, as long as the number is bigger. They become incomparable. So all of these things just slightly above ability. Yeah. You get all this phenomena. Yeah. Okay. Now I want to sort of conclude with saying something about co-cycles. So these are sort of, you know, some of the results that you get, but how do you actually get such results? So the technique that's being used here, sort of the basic idea. And this is sort of also the basic idea that's being used in the measure theoretic category, is to study co-cycles. So let me give the motivation for this. So I have an equivalence relation E that is given by a free action, let's say, of a group, let me give it a name, G, on some space X. G acts on X. I will just say something very general now, and then I will sort of specialize a little bit. And suppose you have another equivalence F, which is given by an action of another group, but which acts freely on Y. Okay? And let me assume that I have a reduction from E into F, which is given by some map, pi, from X into Y. So what does that mean? That means that X is equivalent to Y if and only if pi of X is equivalent. Pi of F is equivalent to pi of Y. Okay? In fact, I don't really care that this is a reduction. I only care it's a homomorphism. Okay? If it's a reduction, it's even better. So let's assume we have a homomorphism from mean to f. Of course, anything that's a reduction will automatically be homomorphic, so that's even better. Well, let's see, what's the picture here? Well, the picture is very, very simple. All right, let's try to see what's going on. Here we have a space x. And here we have a space y. And we have, let's say, an element x here and an element y equivalent to it. Well, what does that mean? That means it's of the form g, I'm sorry, let's apply some element of g, get g of x. Well, let's follow pi here. We get pi of x. Here we get pi of y, which is pi of g of x. But because it's a homomorphism, this is supposed to be f equivalent, which means there must be some h which is going to send this to that. Well, let's give that a name. It depends on what? It depends on g and x something, huh? Call it alpha g and x. Well, what does this alpha do? Well, it has an obvious homomorphous property. That simply follows by first using G1 and then applying G2 to that. And that's what is. So what is this alpha? Alpha is a mapping from G cross X into H. And it has this property, which is the obvious analog of the concept of homomorphism. For example, a trivial way in which this can be true is when the alpha doesn't depend on X. It doesn't depend only on G. So it's simply mapping from G into H. If you write this down, this is just going to be homomorphism. So it's a homomorphism concept for actions. So let's call the cosine. So what's the idea here? Every time we have a homomorphism, in particular if we have a reduction, we have a cosine. So what you want to do now, what we study here, is this cocycles. We try to understand these cocycles, and in particular, most of the sort of the main technical results, I mean, from which all the other stuff follows about when you study the superadditive theory, is what are called cocycle reduction theorems. They are theorems that tell you you can replace the cocycles by other cocycles which are simpler. And in what sense they are simpler? They have simpler range. In other words, you can replace, instead of using all of H, you can replace it by a small piece of it. Or they have some simpler form. For instance, they could be homomorphisms. So in what sense you can replace them? What do you say you can reduce them? Well, if we think that we had another reduction, another homomorphism, rho, from x into y, that happened to send, suppose rho of x, it's just an inessential change of pi, basically. Namely, it sends it to something which is equivalent to it. So it moves only, doesn't move the equivalence class of pi of x, it just moves the actual element, but in the same equivalence class. Then, of course, this pi, this rho, would be given by rho of x would be given by applying some element of h, let's call it f sub x, depends on x, applied to pi of x. Right, because it's equivalent to x. And then if you look at the cocycle associated to rho now, remember every homomorphism has a cocycle. If we call beta the cocycle associated to rho, then we have a relation between them, which is this. The cocycle associated with rho is related by this formula. So if we make an inessential change, so this is associated with pi, this is associated with rho. If we make this inessential change from pi to rho, we change the cosine as the cosine better related like that. Well, if we have this formula, if two cosines are related like that, then we say they are equivalent or cohomology. So what does that mean? It means that there's a function f from x into the group h, which relates alpha and beta like that. You can easily check that's an equivalence relation. So you say that so changing things inessentially produces equivalent cosines, but you can go backwards. If an alpha and a beta are equivalent cosines with respect to this abstract definition, and alpha is associated with pi, I can define rho like that and show that the cocycle associated to beta is pi. So if you replace a cosine by an equivalent one, that's essentially saying you're replacing the reduction by another one which is really inessentially different from that. So now the main sort of theorems along these lines tells you that when you have cosines from certain kind of groups and certain kind of actions to other groups, certain kinds of other groups, and you have a cocycle alpha from the first action into the other group, then you can find a beta equivalent to it, according to the definition, so that beta is much simpler than alpha. What the much simpler can be? Well, there are various cases. Beta could simply be a homomorphism independent of x. Or it could have a small range. The range of beta, I mean the image of beta, beta g cross f, it's a subgroup h, zero of h, which is simpler than h. For example, finite or amenable, something like that. Well, what does that mean? Well, that means that if your original alpha, now how do we apply that? Suppose the original alpha came from a homomorphism or a reduction pi. We apply this sort of reduction theorem to find out that there is another reduction, rho, whose associated cocycle is very simple. For example, let's take a special case where the associated cocycle beta for rho now takes values in an amenable subgroup. But if you go back to the definition, so let's assume, let's say, from the beginning, therefore, that the cocycle associated to pi took values in an amenable subgroup. In other words, that this alpha here comes from some amenable subgroup. Well, what does that mean? If our original thing was a reduction and two things were equivalent here, their images would be equivalent by this h, which is alpha, which is in some amenable subgroup, which means that you actually have a reduction from your original equivalence relation to a sub-equivalence relation here, which is given by an amenable group, amenable subgroup. Therefore, it's hyperfinite. Therefore, the original thing would be hyperfinite because you have a reduction from a hyperfinite thing to a hyperfinite thing, but usually the things that you work with are not hyperfinite. So it's a contradiction. That means there can be no reduction. There cannot be no Borel reduction of the things you're studying into something else. So that's the machinery. That's sort of the idea. You assume there is a reduction. This gives you a cocycle. Then you prove some general theorem about cocycles in the context of the groups and the actions that you're working with. And then these theorems usually are strong enough to get you a contradiction like that. So this way, show there are no reductions and no very distributions and so on. Same things that you can also use to, I mean, many times, for instance, how do you prove stronger rigidity? And sometimes I said, even just having a reduction or an isomorphism in the measure theorem gives you that the groups are the same, or one group is containing the other. Well, this is going to happen, for instance, many times when you, this cocycle alpha, you show that it's not equivalent, say, to a cocycle that takes values in a small subgroup, but it's actually a homomorphism. Now, it doesn't depend on it. Well, if it's a homomorphism, it gives you a homomorphism from G into H. Then you argue that this probably is going to be one-to-one, or onto, and you get an isomorphism between G and H. So that's how you can get stronger. But you need to know more about your reductions and et cetera, et cetera, in this case. But this is sort of how you start and, you know, how you sort of implement this method. Okay.